ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Thursday, the 26th of February. I'm Melissa Clark in Canberra, coming to you from Ngunnawal country and acknowledging other custodians. Alleged bomb threats to the Australian Prime Minister's official Canberra residence and a Gold Coast theatre have thrust a Chinese dance group tied to a spiritual movement into the spotlight. Shen Yun and Falun Gong have been criticised by China and Chinese embassies across the world, with claims their performances contain hidden political elements and maliciously slander the Chinese government. Political reporter Lexi Junawick explains.
Shen Yun's concerts are renowned for their meticulous, synchronised choreography.
A performance that truly matters for each and every one of us.
But behind this dazzling spectacle is a controversial Chinese spiritual movement, Falun Gong, with anti-communist beliefs.
This is a very effective way of Falun Gong delivering its message and delivering it to a mass audience beyond its own believers.
Graham Smith is an associate professor at the Australian National University's College of Asia and the Pacific.
Falun Gong came into prominence, I guess, in the 1990s. The group really gained fame when they staged this protest against their labelling as an evil cult. What they did in protest is they managed to surround the Chinese government's compound, Zhongnanhai in Beijing, without the police knowing, without the security services knowing. And this, not surprisingly, gave the regime a huge fright that there was a group within China with a huge number of members that was better organised than it was.
Shen Yun and Falun Gong are back in the headlines in Australia this week in wake of alleged bomb threats ensnaring both the Prime Minister's official Canberra residence and the Gold Coast's Home of the Arts Theatre. An email was sent to Shen Yun's local organisers falsely claiming that explosives had been placed around the lodge and that they would be detonated if Australian performances by Shen Yun proceeded. Mr Albanese was evacuated on Tuesday night, but nothing suspicious was found.
I think it's just a reminder. Take every opportunity to tell people, turn the heat down, for goodness sake.
Bethany Allen heads the Australian Strategic Policy Institute's China Investigations and Analysis. She says Falun Gong, which has a presence in more than 100 countries but is banned in China, and its dance troupe have been at the centre of abuse allegations in recent years.
There was a New York Times expose a couple of years ago about how they interviewed 80 different former performers with Shen Yun, who accused the group of essentially child trafficking, of abusive working conditions, and of, you know, using performers to earn money for this religious movement.
The first of Shen Yun's Gold Coast shows went ahead last night as planned, but days earlier the venue was evacuated after receiving an unverified threat believed to be linked to the performance. There's no evidence the Chinese embassy or Chinese government is behind either incident. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson Mao Ning.
I do not know what actually happened. China always opposes violence attacks of all kinds.
It's not the first time that Shen Yun has faced bomb threats. Last year, the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts in Washington, D.C. was evacuated ahead of an opening night performance after receiving an email claiming an explosive device had been placed at the theater. Associate Professor Graham Smith believes this week's incidents on home soil won't be the last.
It's just next time, but won't be quite so surprising.
ANU Associate Professor Graham Smith ending that report from Lexi Junawick. And AM has approached Shen Yun Performing Arts for comment, but is yet to receive a response. A sexual violence expert says more than 90% of incidents in Victoria go unreported, with confusion about legal grey areas deterring victim survivors from coming forward. Advocates are calling for an anonymous and informal online reporting system for victims in the state. It comes after a female hiker in Victoria alleged she was assaulted by a man while walking alone in the bush. Eden Hanenan with this report.
Georgina Hayden has spent the last decade speaking to the police, sexual assault support workers and victim survivors about reporting assault. She's a professor in criminology and justice studies at Victoria's RMIT University and says community confusion around sexual assault can often lead to victim survivors feeling unsupported. That's why she believes the true rate of offending is unknown.
If you don't know it's happening, then how can you prevent it? With sexual violence, we get, you know, 8% maybe of incidents getting reported. So in terms of what we know about sexual violence, how it's perpetrated, the methods, the means and so on, it's like we're looking through the keyhole to try and see what the whole room looks like.
It comes after a female hiker in regional Victoria alleged she was assaulted by a man while walking alone in the bush last month. Sarah Gibbs says the man touched her hair and hand and used sexually explicit language before attempting to subtly move her off the path and into the nearby bush.
I don't think I've ever come that close to knowing, like, this is over for me. I'm gone.
Miss Gibbs says the police did nothing.
So it takes, like, for a man to actually physically do something, for you to do something?
Victoria Police initially said the hiker was not a victim of a crime, but in a subsequent statement says there is now an active investigation into the incident. Professor Hayden says despite authorities working to break down barriers, many victim survivors still have a distrust of police and fear they won't be believed. Professor Hayden is calling for an anonymous and informal online system that she believes could lead to earlier interventions for victims.
Provides an opportunity for victim survivors to be connected with support services, to tell their story in their own words, and it provides police with a source of information, particularly about perpetrators' modus operandi.
A West Australian reporting system launched in July 2023, named Safe to Say, has led to 42 arrests and 178 charges for more than 2,000 anonymous reports. Professor Hayden says many incidents, like sexual harassment, fall into legal grey areas, and so victim survivors are reluctant to report this to police.
And if there's confusion, then you're not going to get clear reporting data from people because they're going to be reluctant to come forward.
Jared Behan is an accredited criminal law specialist and chair of the criminal law section at the Law Institute of Victoria. He says there are four legal elements to prove beyond a reasonable doubt in a sexual assault case.
First of all, that the accused person intentionally touched the complainant in the way that is alleged. Secondly, that the touching was of a sexual nature. The third point is that the complainant did not consent to that touching.
Mr. Behan says the act alone of touching someone's hand or head may not be considered sexual in nature, but the circumstances in which it happens needs to be looked at. As well as in combination with words or actions, it might then have a sexual connotation.
The fourth point is that the accused did not reasonably believe that the complainant consented to the touching.
Mr. Behan says these elements need to be proven by the police and the prosecution in court for a person to be found guilty of sexual assault.
I'm not really in a position to comment on the police investigation in this case. However, the community has a right to feel safe and to have their concerns addressed.
Criminal lawyer Jared Behan there, ending that report by Eden Henninen. One industry predicted to grow rapidly is data storage, with AI fueling demand for centres that house IT infrastructure. But there are challenges with power and water needs. And in the US, the President Donald Trump has announced tech companies will have to provide their own electricity. Australia is looking at strengthening requirements here for new data centres, as Annie Guest reports.
In his wide-ranging and record-length State of the Union address, US President Donald Trump signalled new rules for a burgeoning industry.
Many Americans are also concerned that energy demand from AI data centres could unfairly drive up their electric utility bills. We're telling the major tech companies that they have the obligation to provide for their own power needs. They can build their own power plants as part of their factory, so that no one's prices will go up.
Electricity-hungry data centres are worth big money. Last year alone, they attracted $10 billion worth of investment in Australia. And with the rapid acceleration of AI, the industry here is expected to grow fourfold within a decade. That means its power use could climb from about 1% to 11% of the nation's total electricity consumption. So Professor Joel Gilmore from the Climate Council is watching developments in the US closely.
It's certainly something where governments should be trying to look at a coordinated approach to these data centres and what we expect from them.
Do you think that Australia should follow Donald Trump's lead on this?
when we're talking about new data centres being developed, it's really critical that they are being supplied with new renewable energy. So they should be bringing their own power supply, whether that's done through regulation, whether it's done through engagement with the grid operators. That's a question that politicians will need to grapple with.
A spokesperson for the Minister for Energy, Chris Bowen, pointed to his comments yesterday that governments do need to ensure investment in new energy accompanies data centre construction. And the federal government is working with states on principles to manage the energy and water requirements of data centres. Belinda Dennett is the CEO of Data Centres Australia, which represents companies including Amazon and Microsoft. She says Australian law already requires big tech to pay power companies for additional generation and the necessary infrastructure.
Data centre operators are already required to pay for energy connections, including the upgrade of substations, the upstream transmission. And so we are seeing them bring their own energy, if you like, through these mechanisms and offsetting their energy use. About 70% of that is offset through renewable energy.
It comes as the Australian Conservation Foundation, Clean Energy Council and Electrical Trades Union call for legislation requiring data centres to expand Australia's renewable energy supply rather than relying on certificates or offsets. But the Minister, Chris Bowen, hasn't made that commitment. With Australia's major renewable projects and transmission lines stalling, Belinda Dennett points out data centres' investment in renewables is contingent on those projects progressing.
They and their customers all have net zero by 2030 targets. So they are doing often jointly power purchase agreements to offset their energy with renewable energy. And what we're finding is that's supplying an additional 1.5 terawatt hours of energy to the grid.
The OECD has warned the power-hungry data centre sector could risk Australia's net zero targets.
Annie Guest there. One mother's advocacy for her son's right to access their local public school has made history. Australia's first class for students who are deaf and blind has been set up in a mainstream school after ABC News reported the family's struggle to get the right support for their child. The school is quickly discovering that access for one student paves the way for many others. More from Disability Affairs reporter Naz Campanella.
Mwah. Bye.
Drop-off time is bittersweet for New South Wales mum Jamie Bennett. Her four-year-old son, Ari, who is deaf and blind, has just started kindergarten at Tanambit Public Primary School.
He is not needing me as much as I thought that he would. So far, it's been a really good experience.
Ari, who also lives with cerebral palsy, communicates using touch. Because he can't see sign language, he has to feel it either by hand or on his body. To make it work, he needs one-to-one support. Ms. Bennett chose Tanambit School because it had a class for children who use sign language. She felt the staff and students would understand Ari's needs while also giving him access to mainstream education.
I wanted him to be supported and included.
Last year, the ABC reported the trouble Ms. Bennett was having securing support for Ari to be in a specific hearing class. So what exactly was the issue? If Ari was enrolled in a mainstream class, he would have been offered one-on-one assistance. But Ms. Bennett was told by the New South Wales Department of Education they could not fund one-on-one support in the hearing class because it was already a funded environment.
So it didn't really make sense, but nobody seemed to know how to fix that.
But late last year, Ms. Bennett was told the department was setting up the nation's first class for deafblind students in a mainstream public school. Tanambit's principal is Deanne Brown.
Deafblind classes exist within schools for specific purposes, and having that inside a mainstream setting, I think, just took a little bit of time.
To accommodate Ari, the school has hired a teacher who is deaf and uses tactile sign language, as well as a learning support officer to work with him. The school has also upgraded its grounds, including installing ramps and a new drop-off zone. Ms. Brown says it'll have benefits for a range of children, but especially others who are deafblind.
There is now a process and a system that other students can look at as a model for accessing education.
The CEO of Children and Young People with Disability Australia is Skye Kokoski-Moore.
We have a good outcome this time, but we know that there are hundreds, if not thousands, of families fighting at this very moment for their school to welcome their child with disability.
She says including students with disability in mainstream schools sent a powerful message.
Students with disability belong, and that they're able to engage with the curriculum and get to enjoy all of the benefits of education without needing to be segregated or separated on the basis of their disability.
Finding a way for Ari to attend the school wasn't easy, but Jamie Bennett says it's the right thing for Ari and others.
Being included helps Ari to develop and grow, but it also makes other people more aware and more inclusive.
That's Mum Janie Bennett ending that report by Naz Campanella. If flying at more than 5,000 kilometres an hour sounds like something you'd be keen to do someday in the future, well, this next story is for you. An Australian aircraft designed to travel at hypersonic speed is making its first test flight this morning in the US state of Virginia. The engineers behind the technology say it'll eventually allow people to travel to the other side of the world in a matter of hours. David Sparks has more.
They've put a bit of tension on it to start.
Engineers in Brisbane test the materials and parts needed for flying at unimaginable speeds. This is the home of Queensland Aerospace Company Hypersonics Launch Systems. And this morning, Australian time, their very sci-fi looking aircraft is launching for a test flight from a NASA spaceport in the US state of Virginia. Chief Technology Officer Michael Smart is there.
So Mark 1 is the speed of sound, which is about 1,000 kilometres per hour. Hypersonic is more than five times that, so more than 5,000 kilometres per hour.
The autonomous aircraft is called DART AE. It's 3.5 metres long, black, and very, very pointy.
As you might expect, it's very sleek and slender. It's not a knife, as we say in as the name of the flight program, which is a very cool name. But it's pretty sharp, though. It's like the way I
best describe it. You mean literally sharp? When you say sharp, do you mean literally it has sharp edges?
Literally sharp, yeah. Mm. Yeah. It's pretty much like a surfboard, but it has a rudder and little wings in addition to help us to control it as it flies.
And the crucial technology is its Spartan scramjet engine. It's 3D printed and contains no moving parts.
The best way to think about it is it's just like a jet engine. It uses the air to pass through itself and the oxygen in the air, and we use hydrogen fuel to generate thrust, and we're able to use that as a propulsion system.
It's hoped the technology will one day allow passenger aircraft to launch beyond the atmosphere and travel with incredible speed to destinations on the other side of the world.
What we want to do is be able to fly to space like you're flying Qantas, and so be much more flexible. The thing in space, the orbital plane that you go into is a very key thing, and we want to be able to, our technology enables you to adjust that pretty easily.
In today's test, DART AE will be carried by a specially built rocket into the upper atmosphere, and at the right moment, it'll separate. The scramjet engine will then ignite, powering DART AE to hypersonic speed.
Back in 2004, NASA did a flight test of a hydrogen-fueled scramjet-powered aircraft, which flew for a very short time. We're flying a similar aircraft, but for a much longer time and a much longer distance. So it's been 20 years since an aircraft like this was flown, but the one we're doing is much more advanced.
The company's CEO, Matt Hill, is also in Virginia for the test flight.
Nothing like this has been done since 2004, and what we're doing is much more ambitious because we're doing it for a much longer period. So it is really, really special, and it's something that all Australians should be really proud of.
The key thing is that all the technology that we're flying, it was designed in Australia and it was manufactured in Australia, and I'm really proud of that fact, and I really want to, to be an example of what we can do in Australia.
Dr. Michael Smart from Hypersonics Launch Systems, David Sparks reporting. And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Melissa Clark.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast.
He spent almost 2 hours outlining what he believes to be a myriad of achievements. But has Donald Trump convinced voters that his first year in office has been a raging success? Today, Dr. Emma Shortis, a US politics expert at the Australia Institute, on President Trump's State of the Union address. Look for the ABC News Daily Podcast on ABC Listen.